I'm going to try something tonight. I did it last night and didn't work. I'm going to try it tonight. Good evening. Wow. A reformation in the culture. I'm impressed. Well, last night I said good evening and I thought there were 300 fossils in the room. Well, today we actually went on a little bit of a tour and saw those stones at some place I can't pronounce. And, you know, the stones in the ground, the stone circle and that sort of thing. And we're out there and I thought there was another ice age coming. There's a cold wind. So I thought I'd start off and show you a little video on the ice age. And particularly today as people are talking about global warming. And in fact, my wife and I were just up in Alaska. We were on a ship up in Alaska. We had a cruise for AIG people in America. We had 500 people on the ship just from Answers in Genesis. And they sailed up to the face of a couple of the glaciers, and the park ranger got on board and said, you know, 200 years ago these glaciers were right down to the coast and they melted back very quickly and here they are today. And then she blamed it all on man and industrialization and global warming. But 200 years ago we didn't have those sorts of problems. And we explained to our people it's because it's the ending of the flood. And there'll never be another flood again, which means there'll never be another ice age again, so get reused to global warming. And I thought I'd show you this little video to start with, one of the videos in our Creation Museum. I'm going to give you a little walk through the Creation Museum tonight, just to show you what it's all about.
The ice on Greenland and Antarctica is in places miles deep and hundreds of miles wide. In the present, however, all but the edges of these ice sheets are cold deserts. Not enough snow and ice falls there to build up the depth of ice that we find today, even if long periods of time were available. The flood of the Bible may provide an answer. First of all, flood rocks contain thick piles of lava and huge volumes of volcanic ash. Meteorologist Mike Ord has suggested that this might have led to the ice age.
There's a lot of warm water added to the pre-flood oceans from the crust, and also a lot of lava flows and volcanism that heat the waters.
Evidence in fossils suggests that the oceans were warmed up in the course of the flood.
The average temperature of the ocean is 39 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, after the flood, it could have been an average of about 86 degrees Fahrenheit. And you could have taken a swim in the Arctic Ocean right after the flood. It was so warm. But then it's going to start cooling down, and that cooling is mainly by evaporation. So the key here is that for that warm water, you evaporate so much more water vapor in the air.
As the oceans cooled after the flood, heavy snow began to fall. Computer simulations that begin with warm oceans show snow falling far inland over cool continents. Ice sheets build up thousands of feet thick, where we see evidence for such ice today. This ice built up in only a few centuries of time. The whole process was sped up by volcanic ash cooling the earth after the flood.
Because of the instability of the earth after the flood, there'd be a lot of volcanism. Aerosols are tiny particles, about a micron in diameter. And they'll float up there in the stratosphere for several years. And they reflect sunlight back to space. So you have a cooling mechanism. The ice is going to build up, and then finally it's going to come to a point where it's going to peak. That's glacial maximum.
Once the oceans cooled enough, the evaporation slowed, the snows stopped, and the ice began to melt. Calculations suggest that the buildup, movement, and melting of ice did not require many thousands of years as is traditionally taught. From a warm world at the end of the flood to the melting of the ice took only centuries of time.
And then I see evidence of the one ice age and the short, rapid ice age that melts catastrophically. This is what I see based on science.
Present climate is not the key to understanding what produced thick piles of ice in Greenland and Antarctica. It looks like the Bible had the key all along, the great flood in the days of Noah.
many people don't realise that you need something to get warm to generate an ice age. And the flood actually provides a mechanism that helps us understand it. That's why we see climates changing today, and they have done ever since the flood, and continue to do. We're still in the settling down phases, in a sense, of the flood. And that's why we see the glaciers melting back and that today. So there's a whole different way of looking at things when you start from biblical history, and again, based on real science, because Mike Gord has done a lot of research in this area. Last night I talked on the fact that the history in Genesis 1 to 11 is foundational to the whole of the rest of the Bible. And that history is what has been attacked in this day and age. And we talked about all sorts of interesting topics last night. Well, we just opened a creation museum in northern Kentucky. It's in the greater Cincinnati area. Sort of gets confusing because Cincinnati is in Ohio. And just across the river is Kentucky. And Cincinnati Airport is in Kentucky. So when you fly into Cincinnati, you fly into Kentucky. And that confuses Americans, let alone anybody else. But that's where the Creation Museum is. It's only 10 minutes from Cincinnati's International Airport. And it received headlines all over the world. In fact, we still have secular media almost on a daily basis. It was in newspapers all across Europe and many other places, and all across America. And I thought I'd give you a little look at it to help you see what we've done there. It's a great teaching place. If you're coming across to America, or if you want an excuse to come to America, this is the excuse to come to America. All you need to do is get to London. You can get a direct flight from London Gatwick Airport on Delta Airlines right into Cincinnati's airport, and then you're 10 minutes from the Creation Museum. So we're not that far away. Costs a little bit, but when you come into the gates here of the Creation Museum, you can see the building here. It's about 76,000 square feet of museum space. That's the portico. And we're still building some exhibits and things, adding things all the time. Putting in some new exhibits. It's evolving as time goes on. There's more construction going on, as you can see there. But as you walk into the main hall, we see a big animatronic dinosaur, 40-foot long sauropod dinosaur, and we see animatronic dinosaurs and animatronic children together. That's become the most photographed icon of the whole museum in the secular world, because it says dinosaurs and people live together and we don't believe in millions of years. So they stop there, take a photograph, and that's where the interviews start, right there. We've even had Al Jazeera there, twice, I think. I've been there. We have some interesting people there. The worst media in the world, as far as I'm concerned, sorry to tell you this, but it's the BBC. It really is. They, out of all the media everywhere in the world that has come to interview us over the past years and recently, I did 80 media interviews in 10 days after the Creation Museum opened, but out of the worst media in the world is the BBC. They mock and attack and misquote more than any of the other media. It's very interesting. Anyway, this is the main hall. And then we have a Digistar planetarium system. This is where you sit back. We take you into the outer reaches of space. And this one's on the size of the universe. And Dr. Jason Lyle, who has a PhD in astrophysics from Boulder, Colorado, wrote the planetarium program. So I'll just show you a little bit of what it's like. But again, people hear evidence against the Big Bang and so on. But the heavens declare the glory of God. And we have people come out of there in tears. Saying it just makes you realize how great God is. So I'll just let him explain a little bit about the planetarium.
Well, I'm Jason Lyle, and I'm responsible for the planetarium programs here at the Creation Museum.
Yeah,
I'm excited
American
about
accent.
The various kinds of things we can do, because we have a brand new style projection system. It's actually a full-color digital projection system, not like those old-style planetariums where the ball with the little pinpricks in it, where all you could see was the stars, and they'd supplement it with slide projectors. No, we've got a full-color digital projection system, and so we can do anything that a standard planetarium could do, and thousands of things that a standard planetarium could never do.
Okay, so you've got to come to see the program. We'll take you through some of the rest of the museum here. We have some live animal displays, actually, as you come into the main hall here. It's all about a walk through biblical history. It's not just about creation evolution. It's a walk through the Bible, the seven seas of history. We have all sorts of fossil displays. We have a finches exhibit. The reason for the finches exhibit is because you've heard of Darwin's finches, but to show all this variation in finches, yet there's only one kind of finches. They're one kind. That's not evolution. That's just variation within a kind. And then we have a poison dart frog exhibit and the chameleon exhibit, the live chameleons, absolutely incredible. This is one of my favorite videos. We produce 50 videos like this through the museum because this teaches us things about God's creation anyway.
The chameleon is an amazing animal. The chameleon can see 360 degrees, like having eyes in the back of your head. and two eyes rotating independently, seeing totally different things at once. If you tried to do that, your brain would go crazy. The chameleon has a tongue that can project up to 2 times his body length. He instantly calculates the projection path, launches his tongue like a catapult, snatches his target with an ingenious suction cup, and snaps his tongue back into place, ready for the next shot. Amazing. It all works together, just as if it was made that way. The chameleon's skin can change color. Maybe he's cold and wants to absorb a little more sunlight so he gets darker. Or maybe he wants to cool off and not boil his blood. He turns lighter. Or maybe he wants to catch the eye of a lady. That's when he really puts on a show. The chameleon is truly a wonder of nature, but where did it come from? Did it evolve from other simpler creatures? Could small accidental changes over millions of years provide small benefits, and then these changes make even more amazing features, like a brain that can process images from 2 independently rotating eyes, or a spring-loaded tongue that shoots twice as far as its body? The origin of such complexity is a mystery to evolutionary scientists, but it makes perfect sense if a creator put all this complexity into the original DNA of the chameleon. Chameleons are masterpieces of design, and the more we study them, the more complex they prove to be.
Well, you can learn a lot of things. And isn't it great to see programs like that from a creationist perspective? We have a world-class fossil collection that you'll see there. This is around the outside of the Special Effects Theater. We have a Special Effects Theater. You go in there, there's a 20-minute program, 3 screens. It's incredible technology with an animatronic girl on stage. And we have all sorts of strobe lights and things. Things happen. The seats vibrate. When Noah's flood occurs, you get sprayed with water, in fact, 4 times. By the end of that, people are on their knees repenting, hoping they're on the ark. So you've got to come and see that. Walk through the Grand Canyon, and we have a ranger station explaining about Mount St. Helens and so on, like I did last night. The dig site, I showed you the video last night of these two scientists at the dig site, different interpretations of the same evidence. And then we head into, from there, what's called the starting points room, like we did last night. 2 different starting points, God's Word or autonomous human reason. That's why you have different interpretations of the universe, of life, when it comes to talking about origins. And then we go into a room, we say, well, we start from the Bible, and so it's a room all about biblical authority and some of the great witnesses from the past, Moses and David and so on. We explain all about the Bible, where it came from. There's Paul writing one of his letters and the whole history of how the Bible has been attacked. And then the Reformation and the Bible in print. We have a working model of a Gutenberg press and the effect of the Enlightenment, the Scopes trial. A man called Charles Templeton. I only ever heard of Charles Templeton. When I was over in Edinburgh and I spoke in Charlotte Chapel a few years ago, they told me that Charles Templeton preached from there in the 50s. He was an evangelist like Billy Graham. Well, Charles Templeton went to Princeton University and was taught evolution in millions of years. And he said, if millions of years is true and there's all this death and suffering before man, which is what I'm going to talk about tonight, the death and suffering issue in the second session, then he said there can't be a God. He wrote a book called Farewell to God, walked away from Christianity, and became basically a help to the atheist groups as they proclaimed atheism. And so we tell people about that. What happens when you take the Bible out of a culture? Like I said last night, if there's no God, who decides right and wrong? We go through Graffiti Alley and see that. What happens when a church compromises the Bible? You notice that the next generation are no different than the kids in the world, because once you compromise in one generation, you often lose it in the next. And then we take you from there through a time tunnel into a theater where you see Genesis 1 is read and a 3-screen presentation, just absolutely incredible. Then you go to the Wonders Room. In the Wonders Room, there are 18 different videos really helping us understand that there's a God. Romans 1:20. That's what it's all about in the Wonders Room. And we could spend, 2.5 hours watching all those videos. And then we walk through the Garden of Eden. We go through biblical history, through creation, corruption, all the animals, Adam and Eve. There's the Tree of Life. That's a massive tree, by the way. If you can see down the bottom here, this is probably about 12 feet high there. You can imagine this is inside the building. It's quite a massive tree that our sculptors did. And answer questions about how Adam could name the animals, and you know, Adam, Eve made from Adam's side, the whole basis doctrine of marriage. We have dinosaurs there. Then we have the fall of man, Adam and Eve, and the waterfall, and because we have lilies and water all in the right places, because this is a pre-fall world here. So none of you got that. That's okay. Well, you didn't want to admit you got it. But anyway, then we go through the Cave of Sorrows. The serpent tempts Eve. Did God really say? So we take you through the whole history of the world, and we're answering the questions as we go through. How could Adam name all the animals in one day? And, well, how many animals did he name? And all of that sort of thing, building the doctrines as we go. The terrible world after the flood. After the fall, I should say. Then the first sacrifice, as a blood sacrifice, as a covering for their sin, a picture of really what was to come in Jesus Christ. We have the first atonement there. And then you come into the fallen world, and there's an animatronic dinosaur eating another animal, and see Adam earning his food in the sweat of his brow, and Cain kills Abel. We come to Methuselah, who talks about the coming, something that's coming. His son, his grandson Noah, has built this ark. You go into the area of the ark. We have 1% of the ark built, and we built it as a real model based upon some of the Chinese and Egyptian ships that had a three-layered structure that would enable such a big wooden vessel to survive in the water. So it's all done from an engineering perspective. We have 12 animatronic figures in there. Building Noah's Ark. And we answer questions all about the Ark. You walk through the Ark, answer all sorts of questions about the Ark and Noah and the Ark and how the animals came to the Ark, how they got on the Ark. We have these are all big three-dimensional dioramas, by the way, to help you understand what it was like inside the Ark and how Noah and his family could have even built that. And then from the flood, after the flood, we go past the Rainbow Covenant and then into the flood geology room, where we talk about what happened during the flood, after the flood. So we cover in there all about the fossils, and we cover the ice age and distribution of animals after the flood as well. So now we've gone through creation, corruption and catastrophe, and now confusion, the Tower of Babel. There's a video there, there's big winged bulls that you can see, and some waterfalls and so on, all about the origin of so-called races and evolution and its effect on racism and things like that, the call of Abraham. We go through all of that. And then after that, we go to what we call the Three Seas Theater, where we have a presentation. It's a 16-minute presentation. We filmed it at the Holy Land Experience in Orlando, Florida, with special actors, special effects, but it presents the gospel in the most powerful way that I've ever seen it presented. It's absolutely phenomenal. And after that, you can come out to a chapel that's done up as a first-century synagogue. And then we have this Egyptian plaza, Palm Plaza, and a water exhibit, lots of fossils in there, coffee shop and so on. And then we have, as well as that, a big dinosaur exhibit that just opened not that long ago. And I took these photos before the dinosaur exhibit opened, actually, but it is open now. And it's got some incredible dinosaur models. Then we have a program here that was filmed in England at a castle. It's on dragons and dinosaurs in a theater. And then there's a big children's area we're building right now, children's interactive area. And then when you go upstairs, you come up to the bookstore, which is done up as a medieval castle with the themes of dragons and dinosaurs. And then after that, after you go through here, we even had a sculptor do George and the Dragon, of course. There's even an animatronic pterodactyl at the front of that. We have a cafe that is themed as Noah's Cafe, and a big mural of Noah's Ark. The idea is Noah lands and dismantles the Ark and builds a cafe in northern Kentucky. And there it is. And then we go outside to the decks outside and the beautiful grounds. We have botanical gardens, we have a carnivorous plant bog, all sorts of bridges and waterfalls, and these will eventually all be signed from a biblical perspective as well. And we're building more and more of these things all the time. Well, there is Nessie. We came over to Loch Ness and found her, took her back over there. There she is in northern Kentucky, and that's our carnivorous plant bog right there. It's the biggest one, well, it's the only one, I think, in Kentucky. Quite phenomenal in all of our picnic areas, and we have a T-Rex topiary and another T-Rex topiary as well, and there are even people coming there to get all their wedding photographs taken there, and it's quite an amazing place. And it was opened on May 28th, and as of today we've had around between 175 and 180,000 people in less than 3 months. So are you all ready to come? It really is quite a place. There's nothing else like it in the world, and so I encourage you, if you can come to America now, whenever you come to visit, you have to say, I've got to go to Cincinnati. Just remember Cincinnati, because we're really in northern Kentucky, but if you remember Cincinnati, you'll be able to find us. We're just 10 minutes 10 minutes west of Cincinnati's International Airport. And I thought it'd be good to introduce that to you tonight because, A, we want people to know about it around the world, because if you're coming to America, we want you to come and see that. Some people come just to see the Creation Museum. And if you come there, you need at least a whole day. Some people spend at least 2 days there. It takes you that long to get through everything. If you want to read all the signs, watch all the videos and so on. But why did we build it? Well, we really built it because of what I was talking about last night. And for those of you who were there last night, I'm sort of following on from that. For those that weren't, this is a talk in itself, but you'll even understand it even more if you're here last night. Remember I said, today people do not listen as they did generations ago when you're talking about the Bible or talking about the gospel. You stand up in the main street of London. I was there, saw one of these street preachers there a couple of years ago, and he was screaming into a microphone. Nobody stopped and listened to him. But you know, generations ago, people would have gathered and listened to such people. Today, when you say God, people don't necessarily think of the God of the Bible. Increasingly, which God? Muslim God, Hindu God, or whatever. We talked about that last night. And one of the things that I did last night was to say that what's happened in our culture is there's been a change in foundation. If you start from God's word, we have a basis for right and wrong, for marriage, one man for one woman, and so on. But the more we have generations taught, no, it's man who determines truth. We're a result of natural processes. Who determines right and wrong? What's happening in our culture, in our Western culture, we see the collapse of Christian morality and an increase in moral relativism because there's been a change foundationally from being built on God's word to being built on human reason. And that's really what's happened in most of our education system. That's what's happened through the universities and colleges. And unfortunately, it's even happened in the churches. Because when churches have adopted millions of years in evolutionary ideas, they're really exalting human reason above God's word. And the next generation recognize, if you reinterpret Genesis using man's ideas, why not reinterpret the rest? Why not reinterpret marriage? You even find in churches people defending gay marriage or defending abortion because of that change in foundation. And so I want to go on tonight and say, okay, what do we do about that? Well, what our whole ministry is all about, I make no apology about it, is to go out and preach the gospel, tell people about Jesus Christ. In fact, when the secular media interviewed me in America, and they would stand there in that main hall with the waterfall, and they'd say, what ultimately are you on about? I said, what are we on about? Well, we're on about to tell people that the Bible's true, the Bible's God's word, the history here in Genesis 1 to 11 is true, and so the gospel, the Christian morality based in that history is true. We're really here to help people understand that they're sinners and they need to be saved and one to the Lord Jesus Christ so they can be in heaven with us. And I remember one of the secular media persons said to me, so you admit you're really on about the Bible? I said, yes, we're on about the Bible. And you know what they said? Well, that is refreshing. You know why they said that? Because in America, in particular, there are a lot of Christian organizations battling whether it's the abortion issue, the gay marriage issue, the Ten Commandment issue, or the evolution issue in schools. And in the public, they don't want to make out that they're really on about Christianity. They're just saying, well, this is not right, or you know, we need to get back to what they call traditional values, which what they really mean is Christianity and Christian morality. And so the secular media said it's refreshing to hear someone actually get up and boldly say, you really are on about the Bible. I said, of course. Isn't it interesting when the secular media say that's refreshing? That tells you something, doesn't it? It really does. Now, we say, okay, here's what I wanted to say to you. And even for people who are not Christians, this helps explain Christianity and explain our world a bit. Because if you were to ask the average Christian, okay, you're going to go out and preach the gospel. What do you mean by the gospel? I suspect most people would say, well, that's the good news that Jesus Christ died on a cross and raised from the dead. Okay. So if you go to some pagan culture and say, I'm here to preach the gospel and tell you about Jesus, tell me something. Do they know who Jesus is? I want you to think for a moment, how would you preach the gospel? How would you preach the gospel if you weren't allowed to use Genesis? Because, you know, in many churches, they say Genesis is not important. Genesis doesn't matter. It's only a side issue. It's myth. It's symbolic. Okay, let's get rid of Genesis. Now, let's go out there and preach the gospel. You sinner! What do you mean by sin? Well, you're a sinner. Well, how do you know you're a... Well, I'm a sinner. Where did sin come from? Look, just accept it. You're a sinner. You know, there is this book called... No, we're not allowed to use that book. So, just accept you're a sinner. Oh, Jesus died on the cross for you. Who's Jesus? Well, he's the Son of God. Oh, why'd he die? Well, because, well, why'd he die? Well, death is a penalty for sin. Well, how do you know that? Where'd you get that from? Well, just accept it. How do you preach the gospel without Genesis 1 to 11? Have a think about that. Do you know that there are mission organizations more and more? There's one particular group in America called New Tribes Mission. Some of you might have heard of New Tribes. Anyone heard of New Tribes? Because I think they have a place over in England somewhere too, don't they? But what they found is when they go into a pagan culture, they used to preach the message from the New Testament. You know what most Christians are told? Well, you start from the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, whatever. Tell them about Jesus. They thought many of these people became Christians until they found out they didn't have a clue what they were doing. They just said the right things just to satisfy the missionaries. And you know what the missionaries found out? They found out that, you know what we had to do? They had to do something so radical it'll blow your socks off. You know what they did? They had to start at the beginning. Now that is radical. You know what they did? They decided to do it the way the Bible does it. Boy, that's a radical concept. Actually start at the beginning, at Genesis, to lay down the foundational history of the creation of man, of the rebellion, therefore defining what sin is, helping them understand why death is in the world. Then they understood the message of the cross. What a revelation! That's how God does it for us. Right there in His Word. And you see, what I want us to understand is this, that the gospel message has its foundation in Genesis. You know, the gospel means the good news, but you can't understand the good news unless you understand the bad news in Genesis. We have increasing numbers of people in our culture who we're trying to tell the good news to. And if we're honest, most churches concentrate on the good news, but if you don't help them understand the foundational aspects of the bad news, they will not understand the culture because that foundational teaching is not there in the culture anymore. That's what I want to help us understand. You see, when I'm talking about the gospel, I like to talk about three major aspects of the gospel. The foundational aspects, Christ has created sin into the world and death as a result of sin. That's foundational to understanding who Jesus is, why he stepped into history, why he died on a cross, was raised from the dead, conquered death, death the penalty for sin, and one day there's going to be a new heavens and a new earth to come, the hope of the gospel. Now, if we're really honest about it, most Christians concentrate on the power and the hope of the gospel. Here, they concentrate on this aspect, not down here. Now, particularly in American churches, I don't know how many of you have heard of, have any of you heard over here of a series of books called the Left Behind series? Anyone heard of those? Put your hand up if you've heard of them. Oh, a lot of people have heard of them. You know, in America, I ask audiences, I tell them, now, don't get worried, I'm not going to talk about eschatology because I don't deal with controversial issues. So I don't deal with eschatology. But here's the thing, and eschatology is a very controversial issue in America, by the way. Mightn't be as much over here, I don't know. But the Left Behind series is to do with, you know, end times, okay? It's a fictional series of books anyway. But the Left Behind series, when I ask, and I'm not talking for them or against them, it's nothing to do with that. This is just a phenomenon I want you to understand. In America, I can have audiences of thousands of people and ask, how many of you heard of, bought, read the Left Behind series? Thousands of hands go up. I mean, millions of copies of those books sold all across America. You know what's interesting? Most of those millions didn't buy creation books. You see, people are more interested in the hope of the gospel, the end time situation. They talk about the power of the gospel and the hope of the gospel. But down here, oh, that doesn't matter because churches have trained people to believe that Genesis is not important. So this doesn't matter. But do you know what? Your views of eschatology aren't going to help you fight the abortion issue or the gay marriage issue or the undermining of biblical authority in the culture. But I tell you what, this area is because this is where the attack has been in this era of history. See, people have missed it. People are more concerned about the power and the hope of the gospel. By the way, you see that in American churches, usually at Christmas and Easter, they have pageants. And in these pageants, they'll have the Christmas story. Maybe you do the same in your churches here. You have the Christmas story. Well, I don't like to call them stories, but you know what I mean. But the account of the babe in a manger. The people, do you know what American churches are finding? The people of the world aren't coming like they used to. And so you know what they do? They increase, now I've got nothing against technology. I use technology. I love technology. But they increase all the lighting and they change the type of singing and the songs and how they do it, thinking that's going to solve the problem. But do you know what the problem is? The problem is we have generations who no longer have the foundation to understand the message of the babe in a manger. They don't have that history anymore. It's not taught in the schools. Many of them don't go to church anymore like they used to. New generations don't have that history. They don't understand the relevance of the message. It's meaningless to them. And the same thing happens at Easter when they have Easter pageants and they have, you know, Jesus on the cross and so on. But if you're going to reach the world, you need to be answering the questions the world has asked that stops them believing the Bible and help them to understand the foundational history so they understand the message of the cross. That's not what's being done. In 1 Corinthians 1:23, Paul says this, "We preach Christ crucified, under the Jews a stumbling block, but under the Greeks foolishness." Now, I hate to tell you this, but I'm the teacher, you're the class. So I want you to repeat the word after me. The preaching of the cross was what under the Jews? A stumbling block. One of the Greeks? Foolishness. Okay. Here's what I want to do. I want to show you something. I find when I do this in churches, a lot of times it's like light bulbs go on all over the room and people say, how come we didn't see this? It is so obvious. I want to show you two sermons from Scripture. And I want to look at them maybe in a different way to how we've looked at them in the past. Acts 2 and Acts 17. In Acts 2, we have Peter preaching the gospel to the Jews, mainly Jews. And in Acts 17, Paul preaching the gospel to the Greeks. I want us to look at that, and then I want us to compare it to our culture today, and I think we'll see some things. In Acts 2, Peter preaching on the day of Pentecost, you can imagine him standing on the temple steps. You people crucified the Son of God. You nailed the Messiah on the cross. But God raised him from the dead, and so on. It was a pretty bold sermon, wasn't it? And when people heard this, they were cut to the heart. So what shall we do? Repent and so on. Save yourselves from this corrupt generation. And you know what happened? 3,000 souls were saved. Wow! And that's what I call a revival. Thousands of people who really were saved. By the way, haven't you seen great revivals in the past, even on the Isle of Lewis? Haven't we seen great revivals in places in England and Scotland in the past, in America, in the New England states, generations ago? Do we see them today like we did generations ago? We don't, do we? Wonder why. Wonder what the difference is there. Well, I want to suggest this to you. You see, who was Peter preaching to? Peter was preaching to mainly Jews or those convinced are very familiar with the Jewish religion. So I want you to think about this for a moment. When Peter said God, did he have to define God? I mean, when he said God, did they hear tree? No, I mean, Prince Charles might hear tree, but when they said God, when Peter said God, they were thinking of the God of creation, right? So Peter didn't have to define God. When Peter talked about sin, did he need to explain what sin was? Well, they had the law of Moses. They were even there to sacrifice animals. They understood why death was in the world. Peter was speaking the same language using terms they understood. See, when I'm communicating to you, see, I'm an Australian by birth and we've lived in America for 20 years. Boy, when I first moved to America, I realized, man, you have to define your terms sometimes. Because, for instance, in America, I told somebody I had a flat battery. They thought I'd run over it. Because they say dead battery. I didn't know that. So when I said my battery's flat, they thought I was nuts. They didn't understand. And then, of course, they don't put petrol in their car. They put gas in their car, which I've never understood because I always thought that gas was not a liquid. And so I had to learn that. And then, oh, one of the most embarrassing ones. In fact, this happened to me just the other day. I was on the telephone with our granddaughter, Kylie, our fourth grandchild. And somebody said, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm nursing Kylie. And then there's this silence on the end of the phone. And then I said, oh, I forgot, I'm in America, I forgot. Nursing a baby in America means breastfeeding a baby. In Australia it means holding a baby. What does it mean here? Holding a baby, yeah. Don't go to America, men, don't go to America and say, yeah, I'm nursing our baby. I tell you, because... that conjures up all sorts of horrible images in people's minds over there. So you see, if you don't understand the terms, you're not going to communicate. That's the point. When Peter was talking to the Jews, same language, they understood the terms. What was the problem? And really, this foundational knowledge was inherent in the culture. He didn't have to convince them that Darwinian evolution wasn't true. That was an issue. They believed in creation. He didn't have to define what sin was. But you know what their stumbling block was? Remember, the preaching of the cross was a stumbling block to the Jews. Their stumbling block was that Jesus was the Messiah. This part, if you like, of the gospel was a stumbling block to the Jews. And so Peter didn't start here. He built on that foundation. If you like, he was speaking to a creation-based culture who had an understanding of the terms, but their stumbling block was the message of the resurrection. And I like to put it this way. The Jews had the right starting point. Remember last night we talked about starting points? The Jews had the right starting point. They had the right history. And that history led up to the message of the cross. They were on the right road, right? Starting here at Genesis, if you like, through. But this was their stumbling block, so that's what Peter mainly dealt with. He dealt with that message. And in fact, what he did was he actually built upon the foundation that was already there in the culture, building from a human perspective. And we know it's God, as we talked about last night, who opens people's hearts to the truth and so on. But he was building the rest of that structure there. Now, I want you to think about that for a moment. And I'm going to mention a person's name. And again, this has nothing to do with talking for their theology or against it or whatever. These are just facts of history. You know, when I was a little boy back in 1959, so I was an extremely little boy back in 1959, my father was a headmaster of a school, and a man called Billy Graham came to Australia, and he actually conducted two big crusades in Sydney and Melbourne. And regardless of what anyone thinks of his theology or whatever, it is true that the Lord actually brought people to himself, and there were people converted through those crusades. In fact, it touched Australia. It's been said in Australia's history, it's the closest Australia ever came to revival. Australia's never had revival, as you've had here, but they said that's the closest. It actually touched the culture. It's interesting. If evangelists go to Australia today, it doesn't touch the culture like it used to. In fact, since 1959, increasingly, they've had decreasing responses. I wonder why that would be. Have a think about this for a moment. In 1959, my father would always have prayer on parade or assembly before the students went into school, because that was the done thing. The students would all have Bible readings before they started their day, because that was the done thing. You see, it's very interesting. Back in 1959, if an evangelist, some preacher, Bible teacher came to Australia and preached like Peter, people would understand, because they knew what sin was. They knew who Jesus was. When you use the word God, most people would understand that's the God of the Bible. So they could communicate and people understand the message. But you know, in Australia today, they don't have prayer on parade before school. They don't have Bible readings anymore. It's been thrown out of the education system, just as it has done in America. There are whole generations today that have never been to church, and they no longer understand the Bible. In fact, some of them, there are some Australians that will say to you, the Bible, what is that? Because there's increasing generations. Oh, by the way, I think there's a few of those in the United Kingdom. Really are. And you know, when you go there today and you say, you sinner, repent of your sin and use the word God, they don't know what God means. Is it Hindu God, Buddhist God? What God are you talking about? Muslim God? Sin? What is that? See, they no longer have that foundation that they had. You no longer get the same response today as you did back in 1959. Let's go on. Paul goes to Athens, goes to Mars Hill. And Mars Hill, he encounters the Epicureans and the Stoics, the Greek philosophers. And he preaches unto them the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Now remember, the preaching of the cross was what to the Jews? A stumbling block. What to the Greeks? Okay, look at this. What is this babbler trying to say? The preaching of the cross was what? It was foolishness to the Greeks. Now, wait a minute. He preached the same message Peter preached. That's right. Well, how come? Well, who was he preaching to? Epicureans and Stoics. Epicureans were basically atheists of the age, if you like. They believed in evolution. They believed that we evolved. In fact, they have gods, but the gods evolved. And the Stoics were pantheists. Pantheism is another form of evolutionism. You see, he was speaking to a totally different culture. He was speaking to a culture that had no concept of the God the Jews understood. So if Paul said God, they didn't hear the God as the Jews would hear, because they had many gods. They had all these temples and so on. If he talked about sin, they wouldn't know what sin was. They didn't have the law of Moses, so they didn't understand. You know what that reminded me of, by the way? Reminded me of my time in Japan. You know, in Japan, less than 0.1% of people are Christians. It's a pagan culture. And I had a Japanese pastor in my office a number of months ago, and he said to me, and I've been to Japan, you know, speaking over there, but he said to me, Ken, we want to translate one of your latest books here. Do you mind if when we translate it, where it says God, we don't translate it as God, but we translate it as the Creator, the true God, the Creator? And the reason is because when I was in Japan, the Japanese translator said to me, do you realize that the Shinto religion, Buddhism, Shinto particularly, is rife across Japan? They have many gods, thousands and thousands of gods. He said, here's a problem you've got. When you say the word God, they will not hear the God you're talking about. He said, I'm going to have to stop and define who this God is. This is the real God who created everything, who upholds everything, and created the first man. I thought, these are going to be long lectures. And then he said, if you say sin, yes, how will they understand what sin is? If they don't have the history in Genesis, which they don't, evolution is taught as fact in the culture, and you've got the Shinto religion and Buddhism and so on, no Christian basis, how will they know what you mean by you're a sinner? He said, you have to lay the foundation from the start, define the terms, before you can ever even help them understand the gospel. Do you know that that's really the situation that Paul confronted? You see, in Japan, they didn't have a Christian basis, so they didn't understand the message. When Paul went to the Greeks, it was an evolution-based culture. They didn't understand the terms, and so it was just foolishness to them. And I want you to compare these two cultures, a creation-based culture versus an evolution-based culture. I want you to think about this as we do this. This was Australia generations ago. This is Australia today. This was America generations ago. This is America today. This was the United Kingdom generations ago. This is the United Kingdom today. And then you think about this. Generations ago, they would understand the terms. Today, increasingly, they do not. Generations ago, this was a stumbling block, but people understood the message. There was a great revival and turning to the Lord. Increasingly today, it's just foolishness. And you see, here's what we need to understand. Do you realize the Greeks were on a totally different road? They had a different starting point. Remember the different starting point? Human reason, autonomous human reason. They had a whole different history, so they're not going to understand this message. So if you think about it, okay, if I want this Greek here to understand this message, what have I got to do? Well, I think it should be obvious. You've got to take this Greek here, over to here, and say, I'm going to give you a whole new starting point, going to give you the history here, the right history, get you on the right road, and then lead you up to that message. Wouldn't that be logical? That's what Paul did in Acts 17. If you've ever read Acts 17 and never seen this, go back and read it tonight before you go to bed. He looked around, you remember. He said, I perceive you are very religious. You have all these idols, all these temples. And he said, you have one here to the unknown God. Let me tell you who he is. And then what does he do? He defines God. He's the one that made the world. He's the creator. And he deals with their false gods. Your gods, no, he's not like your gods. He doesn't need anything. He's not worshipped with men's hands as though he needs anything. No, he gives all life and all breath. And he made of one blood. We all go back to one man. We're all related. He was laying the foundational history and defining the terms. Do you know what he was doing? Taking that Greek off the wrong road, giving them a different starting point. Remember I talked last night about changing starting points? Change the starting point, put them on the right road, and then you know what he did? He got back to preaching the good news of the gospel, the message of Jesus and the resurrection. And you know what happened this time? Here's what happened. Some of them sneered the same as last time. Some said, we want to hear you again. God was opening their heart to the truth. And some believed, only a few. You know, I've actually had people in America tell me, oh, at our seminary or Bible college, do you know what our professor said? Don't get all intellectual like your faith, like Paul did in Acts 17 and only got a few converts. You need to be like Peter in Acts 2 and just go out there and boldly proclaim Christ. Peter was successful, thousands of converts. Paul wasn't. I've got news for you. Paul was incredibly successful. We know it's God who opens people's hearts, but Paul was incredibly successful. You know why? He was preaching to outright pagans who didn't understand. They had the wrong foundation. He had to change their entire way of thinking in that sense. He was incredibly successful. By the way, you know the secular media, when they come and interview me at the museum, they say to me, so do you have non-Christians come through here? Oh yeah, in fact there are big tour groups bringing non-Christians in, which is really great. And they say, what responses do you get from the non-Christians? And I say, oh, there are three responses. Really? Yeah. What are they? Well, some sneer, and some say, oh, we want to hear more about this, and we want to hear this again, and some believe. I don't know, I'm quoting Acts 17. Because that's exactly what we see, by the way. Same thing. Do you know what Paul was doing? Paul was actually, now, please understand me here. I'm using the word Greeks and Jews as types. Paul was actually turning Greeks into Jews. I'm using them as types. Turning Greeks into Jews. He was taking people who had a wrong foundation, wrong starting point, giving them a whole different starting point, a whole different way of thinking. He was preaching to people who didn't have that foundation on which to build, and so he had to take out the wrong foundation, take out their wrong starting point, put in the right one so that they would understand. Now, I want you to think about that in relation to America, Australia, United Kingdom. Let's say United Kingdom here. Generations ago, by and large, I mean, I would say the Isle of Lewis is probably, you know, more Christian than a lot of the United Kingdom. Ireland is also more Christian than a lot of the United Kingdom. And I know you've had some incredible history in regard to revivals and so on. So I want you to step back and look at the culture as a whole. Look at, you know, all the countries of the United Kingdom. Generations ago, they had prayer in the schools, right? Bible in the schools. They taught creation. God created. Generations ago, would you say the United Kingdom, in a sense, would have been more like the Jews or more like the Greeks? What would you say? More like the Jews. And the preaching of the cross was a stumbling block to the Jews, but at least they can understand the message. But let's come up to the present. By and large, creation's thrown out of the schools, prayer out of the schools, Bible out of the schools. If anything, Christianity's taught against. It's just another religion. And if anything, Christians have become more marginalized in our Western countries. Would you say that the United Kingdom is still like the Jews, or do you think it's become more like the Greeks? What would you think? More like the Greeks. And the preaching of the cross was what to the Greeks? Foolishness. Now I want to ask you a question. If we're really honest, sit and think about it. Most of our evangelistic methods, most of our Bible studies, most of our Sunday school material, most of our evangelistic tracts, most of what we do as a church, is it really geared to Jews or geared to Greeks? What do you think? It's geared to Jews. But the culture is like the what? Greeks. Does anyone see a problem here? That's a major problem. Major problem. Friends, I want you to think about this. Look, whole generations have been taken through an education system and they've been put on the Greek road. In America, and I know the statistics here would even be more than this, because homeschooling and Christian schooling is big in America, but still, 95% of kids from church homes go to public schools. Well, I should say secular schools, state schools, 95%. And by the way, the statistic indicates that of those that go to state schools, 70% of them are going to walk away from the church. You see, what's happening is this. Whole generations, even from the church, are being turned into Greeks. And you know what's happening? We're preaching to them as if they're what? Jews. Listen, I want you to apply this to your own churches here, but I'm going to use America as an example because you can apply this. There are areas in America called the Bible Belt areas. And the Bible Belt areas are the hardest areas to get into to speak because they think they already believe it and they don't need anything else. And the more liberal areas we can get into much more easily. It's interesting. But anyway, these conservative churches, I've had the pastor say to me, you know what? We don't need answers in Genesis here because we believe the Bible.
You know, the Bible says it, that settles it, I believe it, that's it.
Oh, okay. But you know what? Some of our people wanted you here, so we're going to let you hear, but we don't really need this. We already believe Genesis. Oh, okay. So I come in and preach a message like I did last night. And then at the end, we have some questions. And guess what people ask? What about the dinosaurs? What do you do with carbon-14? Do you really need to believe in 6 literal days? What about the millions of years? What about Lucy and all these ape-like creatures that supposedly turned into people? And what do you do with the Grand Canyon? And do you know what? They're all Greeks, not Jews. They went through the secular education system. They watched television. And they don't understand. They said, well, we believe Genesis, but they really don't. And they don't know why they do. And they can't answer the questions of the world. By the way, if they're Greeks, what do you think the kids are? Oh, the kids are ardent Greeks. Because I go to speak to the youth groups. And we have questions. Ask me your questions. Yeah, but you can't really trust all of the Bible. By the way, do you know what's interesting? The statistic in America is of those teenagers today who call themselves born-again Christians. Do you know how many believe in absolute moral truth? 9%. The previous generation, it's 44%. They're losing it rapidly, aren't they? I'd say you'd have similar sort of statistics, even worse, in the United Kingdom. You know why? Because the kids are Greeks. And what's happened is what I said last night. We teach them Bible stories at church. We treat them as Jews. But we send them to the Greeks to be educated. Then they think like Greeks, and they have the Greek starting point. And then they come to church and they recognize the inconsistency and they realize if the history in Genesis is not true, how can the spiritual and moral things be true? And they give it up. You know what our ministry is all about? Taking these Greeks and turning them into Jews. That's what the Creation Museum is all about. That's what the Ministry of Answers in Genesis is all about. I put it this way. We need to de-Greekize the culture. Now you might say there's no word as de-Greekize. I know, I made it up. Last year I was at Oxford and spoke at the auditorium in the school there. They hired that auditorium and I spoke on this topic. And afterwards there was an Oxford professor there and he came up to me afterwards and he said, you know, I know what you mean, de-Greekize, but my colleagues, if I use that word, I mean, there is really no such word. I understand what you're trying to do. But I don't think you should use a word. Well, I suppose you can't. Well, it's not a real word. Well, I know what you're trying to say. And I said, oh, okay, thank you. And off he went. A man who was standing behind him looked at me and he said, I really feel sorry for smart people. But you know what? I like that word. De-Greekize. Hey, by the way, people, I want you to understand something. How can we de-Greekize the culture when we've got a Greek church? Because you realize even in our conservative churches, you think to yourself here tonight, you think how Greekized we really are, how evolutionized we are. How many can really answer questions about carbon dating or dinosaurs? Or how many of us have said to our kids, well, we don't know, or it doesn't matter, or the millions of years doesn't matter? The church is so Greekized. That's why the church is not reaching the culture. You know what's happened? The culture has invaded the church. And you know what we do? We tell Bible stories. We talk about Jesus. Don't get me wrong. We need to tell people about Jesus. But we're treating the culture and the church as if they're all Jews. I got news for you. Even the church itself really need to be approached as Greeks. You know when we built the Creation Museum? The script writers came in and sat down and they said to me, okay, who is this museum for? I said, bottom line, it's for Greeks, because then we'll reach the church. We construct it as if people know nothing, then we really will reach the church. We start from the bottom, the foundation, teach them how to think, take them all the way through the Bible, answer the questions of the age, and then we'll reach the church and the world. And you see, what we're on about is taking those people off the Greek road, putting them on the right road with the right starting point. And friends, that's why I said last night, if you think about it, most of our Sunday school material, Bible study material, teaches Bible stories. It treats people as if they're Jews. We're not connecting the Bible to fossils and to dinosaurs. People think the real history of the world, you learn that at school or a museum. You don't learn it at church. You don't do geology, biology, astronomy at church. You don't teach them apologetics, how to defend their faith by and large in today's world. We teach wonderful doctrines, and you can teach wonderful doctrines, but if we don't know how to defend our faith and our children are being educated to be Greeks right before our very eyes, we're going to lose the next generation. We're going to lose them. I mean, how many churches do I go to across England? I don't know. You know, and a lot of Scotland, where there were big auditoriums, and now they've closed in the balconies, whatever, the much smaller churches, and the average age is about 150. And you know, I say to the pastor or the minister, you know, what happens when these people die? Yeah, what happens? Where's the next generation? They're Greeks. That's why they're not in church. They don't understand. You know, it's interesting. Someone like Billy Graham, who people would look on as a great evangelist, he delivered his final revival Bible sermon back in 2005. And to me, it was an interesting situation, because to me, it represented something. You see, his main message was trust in Jesus. He died for your sin. By the way, great Christian leaders in America, and even people like Billy Graham, by and large, many of them have not taken a stand on literal Genesis. He never dealt with that issue. In fact, he told people you could believe in millions of years. And dinosaurs lived millions of years ago. He might have preached the good news of the gospel, but he didn't deal with the foundational aspects. And to me, when he delivered his final revival sermon, or what he called that, I believe it was in a way symbolic of the end of the era of the Jews, because now we're in the era of the Greeks, because his major message concerned Jesus and the resurrection. But we're in a different culture. And you see, even great Christian leaders of all sorts in America, and even people, evangelists like Billy Graham, really helped this change. I'm not saying deliberately, but they did help the change, because they didn't take a stand on Genesis and answer the questions of the age. And that's why when I used those castle diagrams last night, I relabel them for you. You see, what happened is the Greeks, the secular world, attacked the Jews. Foundationally, God's word in this culture, Genesis 1 to 11, much of the church said, we can accept what the Greeks say here and we'll let our kids learn that, but we'll try to keep this structure, the doctrines of Christianity, and they can have that foundation as long as we have that structure. But friends, that structure doesn't stand on that foundation. Do you realize what happened? The Greeks attacked the Jews and got the next generation to be Greeks, to have this foundation. And so, what our ministry is all about, to de-Greekize the culture, we have to deal with that wrong foundation, re-establish this foundation of the authority of the Word, help people understand they've got the wrong starting point, give them the right starting point, answer the questions of the age, so we can deal with the moral relativism in the culture and build the structure of Christianity. Friends, for all of the Christian resources we have, come on, let's be honest, stand back and look at the United Kingdom. It has fallen far. You might have certain churches growing here and there. We might be maintaining something. The culture is heading down. You're losing it. And they are in America. The whole of the Western world. Why? Because we gave up the authority of God's word. And you know, it's no different to the Israelites when they compromise with the pagan religions. You see, we look at the Israelites and say, how stupid. Look what God did for them. Look at the great things he did. And they took the pagan gods into their culture, mixed it with their temple worship and so on. And we say, how stupid. Wait a minute. Do you realize? In mixing evolution and millions of years with the Bible, we've done exactly the same thing. It's no different. We adopted the pagan religion of the age to explain life without God and incorporated it into the Bible. You know what God says? I'd rather you were hot or cold. If you're lukewarm, I'll spew you out of my mouth. And we wonder why we've got problems. Let me finish this with a look at the parable of the sower and the seed. The parable of the sower and the seed. We know that the sower, throwing out the seed, the good news of the gospel, the sower, of course, would throw seed out so it would grow and they could reap a harvest. And we know that, we understand the parable. There's different sorts of ground out there, rocky ground, thorny ground, the birds come and take it away and so on. Here's what I want to suggest to you. Generations ago in the United Kingdom, in most of our Western world, in America and Australia, there was lots of ploughed ground. Ploughed by the homes, the schools and the churches. You had that foundational knowledge of the Bible and understanding of the terms. And so you could throw out the seed of the gospel and you could reap a harvest. But you know what's happened? The same homes, schools and churches have contaminated the ground. The rocks of evolutionary geology, millions of years and so on, biology. And here we are, oh well, This is the way we've always spread the gospel in the past. Well, these weeds are getting worse every day. Oh, well, we keep doing it the way we've always done it. You know, the seven last words of the church. We've never done it this way before. And so we keep doing it all the same way. And what happens? We're losing the culture. We're in a situation today where we need to come in and clear the ground. When the pioneers went westward in America with their wagons, they didn't just take their wagons to an area, put them in a circle, throw out seed and sit back and wait. They actually had to clear the ground and prepare the ground so they could plant the seed so they could get a harvest. That's the situation we're in our Western world today. In fact, the whole world. And the Ministry of Answers in Genesis is like a bulldozer coming in to clear the ground. By the way, I showed this in California. I had someone nearly punch me in the nose for being anti-environmental. And I said to them, wait a minute, you've got to understand, the trees are symbolic, the bulldozer is symbolic, the smoke is symbolic, everything's symbolic, the creationist in the bulldozer is real, and if you understand anything about America, there's no owl or bald eagle in the tree. Maybe you understand that. But you know what that bulldozer represents? That bulldozer represents answers to questions today that have caused people to doubt the Bible, to question its credibility, to say it's not true. These are answers today. Just as Paul and Peter had to have answers in their day. Just as Martin Luther had to have answers in his day. Whitfield had to have answers in his day. And so it goes on. This is an era of history where we need these answers because this is what has caused the ground to be lost. And because God's people allowed it to happen that way. And you'll also notice that in the approach through the Creation Museum and Answers in Genesis is what I call a chronological approach. We do it the way the Bible does it. Radical. Start at the beginning. Explain that history so that people understand. And you know, this connects to the real world. This connects to created kinds. This connects to why there's death in the world and suffering and catastrophes. This relates to why there are fossils all over the earth and this and canyons and so on. This relates to why there are different people groups. And of course, this is the message of the gospel. It's based in that history. See, you can be one of the greatest preachers and Bible teachers in the world, but if we're not dealing with where the battle is at in our age, And people can have a lot of head knowledge about doctrine, but we stand back and we're losing the culture. And friends, that's what I challenge you with. Can you imagine what would happen if we started training up generations that knew the answers to the attacks today? Generations that understood the Bible is a real history book that connects to dirt and fossils and connects to dinosaurs. And I mean, do you realize before ministries like Answers and Genesis really raised up, I mean, there are people in the church thought, we don't talk about dinosaurs. But dinosaurs are used probably more than anything to convince kids the Bible's not true. And the Bible's history explains dinosaurs. It's easy to understand. But we didn't deal with those things. Think about your Sunday school literature. Think about your evangelistic tracts that you use. And in doing that, let me challenge you. For instance, these are tracts that Answers in Genesis have developed. We've developed a lot more too. These tracts, like 6 days or millions of years, is there really a God? Where did the races come from? Where did Cain get his wife? Why is there death and suffering and evolution and creation? And so, do you know what these are? These are evangelistic tracts. They present the gospel, but they're answering a question of the age to help us understand that we can really believe the Bible and it lays that history so that people understand the gospel. These are tracts for Greeks. Most of the tracts we use are for Jews. Think about that. I've written a lot more about this in the book, Why Won't They Listen?, which deals with this whole topic. And again, let me show you how you can use some of the materials that I mentioned last night. Answers Magazine. Answers Magazine will help you de-Greekize your family and develop a true Christian worldview and have the answers to the world so you can more effectively witness. I encourage every one of you to subscribe to Answers Magazine. There's nothing else like it in the world. It's not just a creation magazine. It's not just about creation evolution. This is to help you de-Greekize your thinking and to build a whole Christian worldview. And by the way, I do encourage you to sign up for the newsletter here in the United Kingdom and pray for the ministry here. It would really be important for us. I want to mention to you last night, I said these are the six basic books that I encourage all teens through adults to get and read. I know we're low on the numbers of these, but they can make some up down the back for you if you need them. But the Answers book. Some people actually use some of these as a study. They say, we're not going to do the normal Bible study we do for a moment. We're going to go through and we're going to use this as a course. And they go through and they answer the questions and get the set of DVDs. I've got 12 DVDs down there that sort of go with this. This is a great witnessing book for college students, high school students. The major arguments, Revolution of Millions of Years, used in schools and colleges all across the world, in there, answered in a very, very tactful way. And done in a nice way, and links to web articles and so on. If you get that into the hands of school students and college students all across the United Kingdom, do you know what that could do? That's what you call creation evangelism. It is. And these are the other books that are in that pack, by the way. The How Could a Loving God... I'm going to speak on that in the next session. I want to show you how practical it is that we can take Genesis and answer questions like, how can you believe in a just, holy God with all this death and suffering in the world? That's one of the questions the secular world asks. I'm going to show you how we can answer that. I'm just going to do it briefly for you. My book, The Lie, deals with the importance of the book of Genesis. There are churches in America that use this as a textbook for a Bible study to go through that. And then there's a book written by one of the English authors over here on what's happening in the United Kingdom there and how to answer the questions. We also have a smaller pack, this one here, we call our vital pack. And I mentioned here last night, see tonight you're probably realizing, man, I should have bought 10 times as much stuff as I did last night. And we can help you because you can get the whole library pack and get the best of everything in there. I wanted to mention a few other things to you real quickly. By the way, this one here, it's in the library pack, but you can get this individually. And this comes as a curriculum. How do you train up godly children in an ungodly world? Really gives you some practical ways of doing that. This is a seminar. Hey, if you use this sort of series here, that'll help de-Greekize your church and de-Greekize all your young people and then use it as a witnessing tool. Encourage you to do that sort of thing. This is an all-year-long study on Genesis. These three books here, the beginnings, you know, where did God come from? How do we get the Bible? How old is the earth? The seven seas, through the whole seven seas of history. This one, questions, some of the most asked questions. These have colour inserts that go with them. You can buy more of them off our website. But they're for ages 7 through 12. Do you know what those do? These three here are an apologetics course for ages 7 through 12 to help them defend their faith in today's world. See this book here? It's a rhyme book that I did for young children. We've had more testimonies from parents reading this to their kids, getting to the end where it says, is your name in the Lamb's Book of Life? And a little five-year-old or six-year-old will say, Mum and Dad, I want my name to be in the Lamb's Book of Life, and I'm going to commit my life to the Lord Jesus. We've had that testimony so many times from this book here, and this one as well. There are some great children's materials here. These even for little kids, talking about the Bible and missionaries and talking about the gospel. Incredible materials that are available for kids. This one for young children, dealing with the whole death and suffering issue. These are the sorts of things we need today. And by the way, if you really want a good Bible study on Genesis, this is not a deep theological commentary. Now, you can get deep theological commentaries. This is a scientific and devotional commentary that goes through, particularly Genesis 1 to 11, answering the questions as we go through a great study. And then, you know, we're even producing books like a zoo guide and aquarium guide. You know why? They're all from a biblical worldview perspective. It's all to help de-Greekize the church so that you can then de-Greekize the culture. You know, it's interesting, after I give a talk like this, I often have people come out and say things to me like, oh, you know, I just realized why my uncle, he's a Greek. And I just realized why my pastor, he's really Greekizing the church. I need to do something about that because he's telling them they can believe in millions of years in evolution. No wonder we're not getting anywhere with the young people. People start to see it. Isn't it like a light bulb going on in your head? It is, isn't it? It's good to go back and just read Acts 2 and Acts 17 and then stand back and think about it from that perspective. Wow. And you know what it means? I think we need radical surgery for a lot of our Bible studies, our youth group studies, our Sunday school material, our evangelistic outreaches. If you want to go and reach the culture out there with the gospel, if you start thinking in terms of how do I reach Greeks instead of I'm just going to use the same old way we've taught Jews, I'm going to go out there and reach Greeks, you know what you do? You start to think, well, wait a minute, to do that, I need to make sure that we're laying the right foundation. I need to make sure that we're answering the questions of this age. I need to help them understand they're on the wrong road. They got the wrong starting point. It'll revolutionize the way you evangelize, revolutionize the way you witness. Well, anyway, that's a little introduction to creation evangelism. And I hope it challenges us and think about that. And I hope you see why we have such a heart to get this material into people's hands and into our churches. I encourage you to do that. We're going to break for about 15 minutes. Again, I'll promise to finish at 10 o'clock. And the last session I want to do is a practical one. How do you answer the question, how can you believe in a loving God, a just God, with all this death and suffering in the world? And I want to go through and show you, if you believe in a literal Genesis, you have some incredible, powerful answers. Modi has just one announcement here, and then we'll break for 15 or 20 minutes. We do? Okay, we've got to finish a quarter to 10. Okay, that's news to me. Okay, I'll talk fast. So we'll just break for about 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, it's a book break. Can I also remind you that it is, you know, we've had to meet a lot of expenses to fly Ken over here, and we hope that you'll contribute towards that. We've got a box in the foyer. I'll say no more than that. Thanks, Ken. So about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, and then back here, please. Thank you.